Hi, I'm Marie.
And I'm Emily.
And we're registered dietitians who love to look at the research when it comes to all things diets and supplements.
With years of working with professional and collegiate athletes, we've seen it all, and we're here to set the record straight.
On this podcast, we break down popular diets and supplements to let you know what's legit
and what's BS.
Versus BS podcast. Today we are talking about nutrition care within the trans population. So a little background of this episode and kind of how it came together. So not too long ago, you guys might remember we did an episode on RDAs. Part of what inspired that episode is a listener had reached out to us, said, hey, you know, RDAs are gendered male and female. What do you do if somebody is trans? And I think that we basically said, we're not really sure if we know the answer to that, was kind of
the true answer of how we answered that.
Yes.
Yeah. So after that episode, we had somebody reach out to us. He was a listener and fellow dietitian named Barry Glassman. He is also a trans male. And he said, hey, if you're interested, I actually have a clinical answer to that question. And we said, yes, we would love to know the research. And then he then connected us with someone named Dr. Whitney Linzenmeyer. She spearheads pretty much the majority of research that's out there on the trans population. So we have both of them on today. We had two separate interviews with them, but they do know each other and work together. So they mention each other in their interviews. But we are super excited because it's an important population. And, you know, if you are a practitioner, it's something that if you walk into a room and you have a person who is trans, it's very important to know resources when you want to give them the best care. But before we get into all that, if you would like to support the show, if you would like to receive nutrition information, tips, recipes, things that you can apply to make healthful life choices in your life, please join us over on our Patreon, RDs versus BS podcast. And we will have the link in the show notes and in our Instagram bio. If you like our podcast, please be sure to subscribe. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or a 5-star rating on Spotify. Continue to send us any topic suggestions by DMing us on our Instagram at RDs_VS_BS_pod or our contact page from our website, RDsversusBS.com.
All right. So before we get into our conversations with Whitney and Barry today, we just want to introduce them. So Barry Glassman is a transgender athlete, LGBTQIA+ advocate, and registered dietitian. Barry intends to combine his passion for nutrition and fitness with his interest in cultural diversity as a future professional practice. He recently has participated in several health campaigns involving transgender health education and supporting gender-affirming health care. He's also written several pieces for Men's Health magazine that you can find online, and they are focused on body positivity and transgender health. And he was featured in Men's Health Strength and Diversity program in the fall of 2020, as well as their Every Body is Perfect campaign last year. All right. Well, Barry, welcome to RDs versus BS. It's so good to have you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate, you know, just being able to talk about this topic. I think it's super important. So I'm really excited.
We'd just love to start off by just asking you to share your story.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's interesting. I grew up, I grew up on a farm in a very competitive atmosphere. I was a competitive equestrian actually for about 20 years. So essentially I didn't have a very big social life. I didn't really go out. I didn't really do a lot of things that, you know, my peers did. And it was a very pressure filled environment. And I began to develop an eating disorder that was related to feelings of low self-worth. I was very sick. I was probably, I think my BMI was probably around 15 at my lowest point. I think I was around 94 pounds or so. Developed all kinds of medical issues, autoimmune disorders, kidney and liver failure. I have osteoporosis. My hormones essentially shut off. I wasn't producing any. When you have an eating disorder, you essentially, and I shouldn't speak for everyone, but for myself, I felt that I was just sort of this walking shell of a human being. I had no personality, no interest in life in any way or daily activities. And I reached a point where I just had to ask for help or I was just going to self-destruct, essentially. So I did find that help, and that really got me very invested in my own health and in food and nutrition, ironically, because that was the way that I gained my strength back, was using nutrition and food as a source of empowerment. And I thought, wow, I need to look more into this, because if I can find power through food, I wonder, you know, there's got to be other people out there that can find that same strength within themselves. And treating themselves with that level of self-love and appreciation. So I went back to school. I had already had an undergraduate degree in something completely separate, actually in philosophy. The other thing I wanted to mention along with that was with the eating disorder, I think it's now, only now do I recognize the link between body composition and gender identity, which is something that I had not recognized at the time. But weighing so little essentially completely eliminated any of my feminizing characteristics. So I didn't have curves, just I had no hormones, like I said, and I liked that. I didn't like necessarily that I was losing weight, but I liked that I didn't have feminizing characteristics or what we would associate with feminizing characteristics. And that is sort of how I discovered that I was not aligned with my gender assigned at birth. So about 3 years ago, I actually started hormone replacement therapy. And so while I was in school studying dietetics, I was also receiving hormone replacement therapy. The two sort of kind of built upon itself or upon themselves in a really positive way for me. And I found that the more I invested into nutrition and understanding the transgender population, the more I began to appreciate myself and become more confident. And all those values of low self-worth kind of started to dissipate. And I started receiving great opportunities. And I can touch on those later, but that was sort of my story, essentially.
Yeah. Wow. So when you were getting your RD, obviously, you know, major life events going on at the same time as going through schooling, did you foresee yourself using your credentialing to look into research in this, further research, be an advocate, be honestly a trailblazer in the area of gender affirming care in dietetics? Or is that something that kind of happened after graduation? Because we kind of all know how it is. You know, you think you go and get your RD and you're going to do one thing with it. And I know Emily and I are both not doing with our degree what we thought we would. But so is that something that kind of as you that those paths were aligning, you're like, yeah, this makes sense? Or is that something that those opportunities happened after you got your RD?
Yeah. So it's funny you say that, because I think that sort of developed over time, is being able to see that sort of blind spot where, you know, just through my own research, I couldn't find another transgender dietitian, and I couldn't figure out how to address my own nutrition needs. Mm-hmm. And so being able to see that sort of wide gap in the field of dietetics was something that kind of like a light bulb went off for me. So I guess in the sense I didn't start out with that in mind, but it's becoming more apparent to me that it's something that's needed, and it's certainly something I'm passionate about.
Can we dig a little bit into, you know, how would a person's gender identity affect nutrition care and working with an RD?
Yeah, so that's a difficult question to answer, because every person in the transgender community or in the LGBTQIA population has a different set of needs. It depends on their lived experience. It depends on a lot of different factors, similarly to the way you would perform a nutritional assessment on a cisgender person. You know, you look at different variables, you look at their health history, their, you would look at their diet, you would look at anthropometric data, biochemical markers. You know, there's all kinds of different things that you play with. And then with this population, there's that base foundation of information. And then there's also you know, several other questions that you have to ask. Are they on hormone replacement therapy? How do they express their gender? What does that look like to them? Have they had gender affirming surgeries? Because that would require additional nutrition for recovery and things like that. You have to be able to understand and read blood work and their, you know, their lab work accurately with an understanding of where the patient is, if they're transitioning, how long have they been on hormone replacement therapy? What does that panel look like? Are they in the right ranges? You know, and you also have to be able to create or make recommendations for their caloric and energy needs based on where they are. So again, should it be reflecting their sex assigned at birth, or should it be reflecting their current gender identity? So for using me, for example, would you provide nutritional recommendations for me based on being born as a female versus who I am now as a male? And the current literature that I found on that, because that's what I really struggled with, is when do I seek out treatment from healthcare providers as a man versus a woman? At what point is the line crossed there? And the current literature that I found on that suggests that prior to the 6-month mark, you should be provided nutritional recommendations based on your sex assigned at birth or gender assigned at birth. Whereas after that 6-month point, you can base nutritional recommendations on their current gender identity or current sex. And that is sort of what I've gone by for myself. I've tried to do quite a bit of research into other transgender female to male individuals, but because there isn't too much historically documented, it's difficult to see what has worked for people and what hasn't, just because there isn't that baseline knowledge. The other component to keep in mind is that a lot of people within this population do not have the resources to be able to get the help they need. They come from demographics that don't allow for financial stability or access to care, so they are challenged to support their own needs. They may not know where to look for help. So that's, it's also possible that a big group of this population is not even being reported or being cared for, you know, limiting our knowledge again that we may have. So there's a lot of factors at play here. I've had to spend a bit of time working with my current providers. I've had to definitely be my own advocate per se, because I've had really great positive experiences with all my providers. But outside of the Mazzoni Center, where I received my hormone replacement therapy treatments, my healthcare providers didn't, basically, they didn't know what to do with me, because it was, they hadn't had any education on this, you know, in their academic career or in their current practice. If it was blood work, they would just say, you know, I'm not really sure what this means or how to address this. Or, you know, I got a lot of sort of gray area answers, if that makes sense. Because, of course, the blood work that I got, if my hormones were tested, for example, they were all abnormal for me, right? Because they were based off of, you know, female markers in a way initially. So I had to sort of like work with my healthcare providers and get things sort of moved over. And then it was very kind of complicated. And I was very fortunate that I had healthcare providers who were very encouraging and positive and were willing to kind of look for the information and ask important questions. But it's something that needs to be, again, addressed on an individual basis. So you really have to not be afraid to ask questions of your patients within their level of comfortability, of course. Asking them and getting as much information about where they are, what their goals are, like what aligns best with who they feel that they are, and trying to get them there through nutrition. That's not even touching on, by the way, certain minorities within that population. There really isn't any data on, you know, people over the age of like 60, for example, who are on hormones or who have been on hormones for their whole lives. So there's a lot of open space there and not a lot of answers to fill that space.
Yeah, it's like we need more research, like with so many things in nutrition, but this is a place where it really is lacking. So when you mentioned earlier the 6-month point, so like before 6 months, RDA and whatever nutrition you need is based off of your gender assigned at birth, and then after 6 months, is that 6-month point, would that be after starting the hormone replacement therapy. Is that what that's referring to?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I should have clarified that.
No,
yes,
that's fine. That's fine.
So, yes. So that 6 month mark is there is basically like 6 months after you've been on hormones. So you've been on hormones for 6 months. Yeah. Sorry. I should have mentioned
that. No, that's fine. What are your thoughts on that approach? Does that seem to be adequate?
It does make sense to me as like a baseline sort of guideline for people to reference. Mm-hmm. I do think that depending on the age you are when you start hormones, your body can react at a different rate. I've been on hormones maybe for probably about 3 years, and I'm still noticing changes to, you know, my facial hair. I'm noticing differences to my voice, my internal core temperature changes, the actual bone structure of my face is still changing. And that's why I actually created my Instagram, is to put a photograph of myself every week from when I started to see those changes in a visual way. So I think that it's a good start to use as a reference. But if you're looking at it from a way to provide the most accurate care for each individual person, I think you have to do a bit more work to, you know, really assess what that person's needs are. And, you know, looking at those other factors, like I mentioned, their health history, do they have any other health conditions that would influence their nutrition needs? And, you know, putting that, you have to kind of put all the pieces together. But I think as a general guideline, to me, it does make sense, because it was around that point that I really was noticing the majority of the changes kind of hitting me all at once.
Well, even just something you just said is making like my brain's churning. You know, you said that you're 3 years and you're still noticing changes to your face structure. So that's making me think, okay, well, do we need to change calcium vitamin D recommendations for somebody transitioning female to male? Because it sounds like clearly some, you know, bone growth is still going on that you probably otherwise wouldn't see, you know. And typically in the trends in cisgendered females is, you know, once you hit 35 or whatever, you have to be concerned about bone loss. Well, it sounds like you're generating bone, right? Mm. It's just like all these things. I think of this in the sense of like acute care. Like if somebody was hooked up to IV feeding, you know, as dietitians, we know how specific and honed into the correct numbers of vitamins and minerals, and you could literally kill somebody if you get that wrong, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. making sure that those recommendations are appropriate. Blanket statement, and then we can kind of get more into the weeds, but where sort of is the emerging research in this field?
Yeah, so there is, interestingly, there's some research, of course, on the clinical components, but there's a lot more coming out about the psychosocial components, especially looking into, you know, food insecurity with the LGBTQIA population, the impact of social stigma and discrimination, and, you know, the different lived experience of this community and their loss of social support and how that influences their nutrition, or like I should say their eating behaviors. A lot of things focused on mental health, which I think in a way is related to nutrition, in the sense that we carry a lot of emotional connection to the food that we eat and to our nutrition. And we either use nutrition as, you know, reward or punishment, or, you know, we're very tied into food and the way that it makes us feel. And we can certainly use that in a destructive way, like I said, or a positive way. But the research now, because there is so much connectivity to between the LGBTQIA plus population and disordered eating behaviors, for example, there is also this heightened need for literature related to mental health. And that has been a very big topic that I've noticed recently. You know, there is some clinically driven research that, you know, talks about the influence of hormone replacement therapy and the types of typical changes that you would see in someone using feminizing hormone therapy. So, for example, going from male to female versus masculinizing therapy, or going from female to male. So, you know, for example, a lot of the changes you see are weight-based changes, body mass composition changes, waist-to-hip ratio changes, you know, all things that would influence the types of nutrition recommendations you might make. There could be changes to lab markers. For example, masculinizing hormones often result in changes to HDL and LDL levels. They can influence your cholesterol, your triglyceride levels. They can increase your red blood cell count. They can increase your hemoglobin hematocrit levels. you know, there's also been some literature on, like you had mentioned, the bone density changes, which for me was awesome because I had this osteoporosis. And interestingly, I noticed when I was taking testosterone consistently, I actually now have osteopenia rather than osteoporosis, which was really exciting for me because I was only about maybe 23 when I was diagnosed with osteoporosis. That was a great confidence boost for me, but that's another component. And then again, as I mentioned, the psychosocial considerations are often, or seem to be more prevalent now in current literature.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought up some of those lab markers too, because I mean, like you said, it sort of became incumbent on you to educate your own medical providers of like, hey, here's why these are technically out of range or why we're seeing this, but you are somebody who is medically literate, right? Mm. So now imagining somebody who's not medically literate walking into a provider's office and, you know, if all I'm given in front of me is lab work and I see high triglycerides, high cholesterol, whatever, you know, we're having a conversation about fiber and your fat intake and like all that kind of stuff. Well, maybe your intake is totally fine. And because all I'm seeing is lab work and there is no education of like, hey, you might see this be off because this person is currently 4 months into their transition or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's such an important piece because you were able to do that education, but I would imagine most people within that community are not because they're not health literate. Mm-hmm. And now it's sort of falling on these providers who don't have an understanding of why lab work might be different, right? Worst case scenario, potentially very bad medical advice that can make an impact, or having a conversation about fiber and fat that doesn't need to be had when you're, yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, that's okay. That's really not like the underlying like situation here.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And it's interesting you say that because for me, my major takeaway was I'm fortunate enough to have access to this information, but how do we fix the problem of getting the people who need the information when they don't know that it even exists? Like, mm-hmm. How do you connect those two things when they're very clearly separated? And the middleman, which could be the healthcare providers, also don't really have the answers, but could incorrectly make the assumption that they do based on the information that they're given. For me, what I've been trying to sort of think about is how to connect all of those dots together. And it's definitely not something that is easy, per se. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And I think that a lot of medical providers are very like, and I mean, I think we are too, as dietitians for the most part. Obviously, we try and ask contextualizing questions, but we're very like step-by-step based, mm-hmm. right? You know, like there's a certain pathway that you go through to make recommendations.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like I said, the experience I've had has been only positive, and I cannot expect my medical providers to have all this knowledge because it doesn't really exist in that educational format for them to access.
Barry, I know you are also a researcher and you've done some research with Dr. Whitney Linsenmeyer out of St. Louis University, who's going to be on this podcast as well. So we're super excited about that. But I was just curious, what are some of the things that you have researched?
Living through the experience myself, I've kind of been doing research on myself, which seems sure. A little weird. But so I spend a lot of time essentially studying my lived experience, which helps me create really what I feel is more insightful literature for other people, because I'm going through what is already out there and sort of using myself as, I guess, my own experiment, if you want to put it that way. But Whitney, when I first transitioned and I was trying to find information, it was just, her name was just everywhere. She had all the articles I could find she had written, and they were incredibly thorough. A lot of the work that I've done with her has been based on nutritional considerations for the transgender population, what testosterone feels like, how that has impacted my experience with food and nutrition, and also importantly, the way that transitioning has connected me more to my body and my body composition and how I feel now in my own body and using nutrition as sort of a source of empowerment to support those feelings. And I know Whitney has done research in both clinical and psychosocial areas as well. And the underlying trend seems to be that, you know, this connection between body composition, mental health, and then nutrition. And that is kind of where our work has really been focused. A recent grant that we're currently working to have published is a grant that is related to, you know, the transgender population and their nutritional needs, looking specifically at CrossFit athletes. So we looked at several different individuals who are already participating in CrossFit and, you know, took a look at some of their biochemical data, their anthropometric data, the kind of training they did, what their diet looked like, and then, you know, making certain nutrition recommendations, training recommendations, things like that.
Barry, thank you so much for coming on. This is a topic that I am so thankful to have people like you advocating and, like I said at the beginning, honestly, really trailblazing, you know, living a life experience. And as you're living it, going, all right, these are questions from my field of study that need to be answered. And I'm going to link up with the right people and put grants together to study them. You know, that's really, really amazing. So we appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Barry. Really, like, I feel like I have so much to sit and process and think about. And I just really appreciate you being on our podcast. Yeah. And then whenever we have a guest, we also like to wrap it up just by having you share where people can find you, where they can learn more about the research you're doing, and anything else you want to share.
Sure. I mean, so I'm on Instagram. It's at Building Barry, and Barry is B-A-R-I. So a little different spelling. I'm on LinkedIn. I have worked with Hearst Publications, so I do have a profile there as well. Pretty much I'm, you know, that I think that's about it, actually. I really don't do too much social media. No, and I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to, again, continue this discussion. I really appreciate you asking these questions and bringing attention to it, and being interested in discussing it. It's really important to me, like I said, on both a personal level and then a professional level. And I'm really very grateful.
We hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Barry. And now we are going to transition to our conversation with Dr. Whitney Linzenmeyer.
She is an assistant professor of nutrition and dietetics at St. Louis University. She's also a spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. As a dietitian and researcher, Dr. Whitney Linzenmeyer is focused on transgender health and nutrition, as well as nutrition and culinary arts education, and the many social justice issues surrounding food. She's committed to equipping students of all ages with the life skills to grow, raise, prepare, and enjoy their food. All right. Well, Whitney, welcome to RDs versus BS. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We just want to dive right in today and just give you a space. I know we already introduced you, but we'd love to just give you a space to share about your story.
Sure. So I'm a rare story where I actually knew what a dietitian was when I was in high school and wow. Knew that I wanted to become one, right? We like never hear about that. But yeah, I just really loved food early on. And so I actually applied to only one university, which is what you are not supposed to do.
Wow.
But I went to St. Louis University and they had a unique program that combines nutrition and culinary arts, because I really love the like the application side of food and got in and then stayed put. So I have a very, again, like bizarrely atypical and linear story where I stayed at SLU and I did my my bachelor's degree in culinary and nutrition. And then I stayed and did my dietetic internship and master's degree and then worked as staff at SLU for a little bit and was adjunct teaching for our department. Then came on as a full-time faculty member, finished my PhD, and now I'm in my 10th year as a faculty member. So like, again, you're supposed to like move around and get training in places. And I just like stayed put, but it's been a really good ride so far.
So one thing that we definitely wanted to ask you about is how you ended up with your career doing research. I'm not going to say not only just doing research regarding gender affirming nutrition care and the nutrition needs for the transgender population. I would say like you are the person doing this research, because one thing that Barry brought up that I confirmed when doing my PubMed searches, you are on every single article related to that topic. So I guess not only how did you get into that very niche and needed population, but how did you become the person?
Oh, golly. Yeah, no pressure. Yeah, how I got into it, honestly, I was just caring for patients, mostly with disordered eating, at our university's health center. So outpatient setting, and cared for my first trans client. And honestly, to my knowledge, this was like really the first trans person that I'd ever gotten to know and had extensive conversations with, and went to look to our profession of dietetics for any just resources or clinical practice guidelines, or even just kind of, you know, more informally dietitians asking similar questions, and really came up with nothing at the time. But to me, there were so many very obvious kind of questions and considerations to be asking from the perspective of a dietitian providing nutrition care. So really, yeah, the rest is history. That was about 8 years ago. And since then has become my exclusive area of research focus and clinical practice as well.
Speaking of, do you mind sharing with us some of your research findings? Like Marie shared, there are many, many publications out there with your name on them. So yeah, what ones really stand out for you?
One of the topics that I find most interesting, and the question that I think about a lot, especially from an outpatient practice perspective, is just the evolving role of nutrition in the lives of transgender individuals, especially as they might be going through a social, medical, or legal transition. We see that food and nutrition can play a very like powerful and transformative role in their lives. So in one study, we interviewed 10 transgender men, and that was really the primary research question was like, you know, how has the role of food and nutrition evolved throughout your transition? So taking very much like sort of a life course approach. And, you know, a lot of people shared that, you know, food was or had been like a source of kind of punishment and control, like, you know, some disordered eating trends, which that had been already established in the existing literature. Like, I would say that the biggest intersection of transgender health and nutrition research has been at the intersection of eating disorders and disordered eating. So I think that's pretty well established. But what we saw happening as well when people were sharing their stories is that food and nutrition also became a source of like self-care and health promotion and a way to nourish their bodies that were like rapidly changing and undergoing like a second puberty as they were, you know, starting on hormone therapy. So that's, I think, a finding that I'm particularly excited and passionate about is framing food as a source of empowerment in the lives of transgender clients. Our current healthcare model and research model tends to take a very deficits-based approach, focusing on healthcare disparities. But I really see food and nutrition as an opportunity to focus on self-care and health promotion and, yeah, that source of empowerment and joy in the lives of our clients.
So was there anything that in your research surprised you?
I've done a bit of writing about sex and gender and how we collect that very basic demographic data in nutrition research. And I'm talking about like large, you know, nutrition programs like NHANES.
And for the people that are listening that don't know, can you really briefly describe what NHANES is?
Of course. So NHANES, it stands for the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. It is the largest nutrition, basically surveillance or survey program that we have in the United States, dating back decades. And really, it's like the bread and butter of a lot of nutritional epidemiology, you know, studies that are looking at populations over time. So we in nutrition science rely heavily on this data set for a lot of studies, which then go on to inform, you know, decisions about clinical practice guidelines and nutrition policies. We conflate sex and gender in that demographic section, meaning that we're like using those terms synonymously or maybe like going back and forth, using them interchangeably. even though these are very like separate constructs, right? Like sex is assigned at birth versus gender, that's someone's like sense of self and how they fit into the world, you know, as more masculine or more feminine or non-binary or a different term to express gender identity. What that has done in Haynes, for example, is really kind of obfuscate the data set, because we might be categorizing a question as a person's sex, but the way that we're asking them about it is to ask them, what is your gender? And when we look at sort of those follow-up questions, you know, that portion for NHANES is, it's interview-based, the questions are not super helpful. Like if a participant is, you know, having trouble responding, the probing questions are things like, what would you tell your doctor? Which I don't think helps to clarify the situation because, you know, for a number of reasons, but, you know, at baseline, do we trust this doctor? Another probing question is, what was assigned on your original birth certificate? So actually like going back to sex, even though originally they were asking about gender. So, you know, we have this obligation to not only provide like good care, but to be very accurate and precise in how we are capturing even this most basic demographic data, because we know that's going to inform the type of analyses that we're able to do, which are then going to go on to inform nutrition policy and practice. So, you know, when we confuse those two terms, we're just really selling that data set short. And I always think of it as just obfuscating this essential demographic data. It's really also, it's erasing trans people from the data set because we don't have the options, like simple multiple choice, we don't have the options for people to identify as trans. So if they're not in the data set, researchers are not going to be able to analyze that data set and publish studies that, you know, talk about the unique nutrition considerations for trans populations.
Right. And I could see how if that were changed to be more inclusive, then that would get the ball rolling to enable even more researchers to look at trans, you know, nutrition needs and care and things like that. But it's hard right now with NHANES to even identify or say, you know, these are needs for males, these are needs for females, these are needs for trans females, trans men, all of that. So yeah, that's something that I'd never really given much consideration to before, but could potentially have a huge positive outcome for the trans population.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, the good news is that the solution is pretty simple, right?
Right. It's like, yeah.
It's called this two-step approach where we have a separate question, one for sex and one for gender. And then we have much more inclusive response options for gender that includes like transgender or, you know, gender fluid or an option to enter your own gender identity. I always say like, yeah, right now it's one question in the demographic section. If we just added one more question, we could be practicing this two-step approach. And what a world of difference that could make in terms of the available data and just the accuracy, the precision of that data set as a whole, if they can adopt this approach.
For sure. Are we anywhere close to making this change?
So there have been some milestones happening. To me, the biggest one is that a year and a half ago now, the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine published a really nice big report, basically encouraging the adoption of this two-step approach in healthcare and research and administrative settings. And there's different iterations of what that language, you know, needs to look like, but is basically, I think the most important thing is having that separate question for sex and gender. And NHANES is, they are, you know, continuing to evolve how they ask their questions and the type of questions that they're including with each data cycle. I know that they shared publicly at a webinar that they are reviewing options for how to be more precise with that questioning, but they haven't yet published what exactly it's going to look like or if they'll adopt the language that was suggested by the National Academies.
Okay.
So I think it's moving in the right direction. I'm watching closely to see what happens, but I'm excited for it.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, we will be keeping our eyes out for that. I do hope that, you know, that simple change could be made because that would, like I said earlier, really make it just easier for more people to do this research.
Well, Whitney, thank you again so much. This has been awesome. So we just really appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise and hopefully just getting the conversation going with people and just getting people to start thinking about, you know, some of the little things. Is there anything else that you want to bring up? Any personal plugs that you have where people can find you?
I'll just say, yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm glad that you're talking about it. I'm especially glad that you talked to Barry because he's an awesome advocate and has shared his story so publicly on different platforms. And I think that's the dream where, he and other trans dietitians are really leading this conversation, that's what it should look like. I have a group at St. Louis University. We are the Transgender Health Collaborative, and we are on Instagram, and we are transhealthcollab.slu. So this is a group of medical providers, dietitians, other allied health providers who work at SLU, and we collaborate on a lot of different research projects and are trying to put our work out there. So that's where you can find more.
Well, again, thank you so much, Whitney. You're such a wealth of knowledge. We're so happy to have you on the podcast, and thanks for being with us.
No, thank you both.
So as our listeners know, we always start our podcast off with a shit at the grocery store segment. And whenever we have guests, we like to ask them to contribute their ideas. And today we had two dietitians. So let's hear what Barry and Whitney had to share when it comes to shit they've seen at the grocery store. So Barry, I know you are a listener, so you are familiar with this segment, but we would love to hear from you. What is some shit at the grocery store or at any store that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, so I love this segment, first of all, but one of my favorite things, and this is more of a general statement, I guess, not a specific product, but one of my favorite things to see on, let's say, like a protein bar is naturally flavored with other natural ingredients. That's like my favorite thing ever. I'm like, what? So, or it'll just say like artificially flavored and naturally flavored with other natural ingredients.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, so was it natural then? Cause it doesn't seem like it. It seems like that's actually artificial. Oh, or like on candy, certain candies, it'll just say like fat free. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's fat-free. It's a Jolly Rancher. It's just right. Pure sugar. Like, uh-huh. Of course it's fat-free. You know?
Whitney, what is something that you've seen at the store that makes you roll your eyes that would be considered shit at the grocery store?
I love that you all embrace curse words, too.
We do.
We do. We love curse words.
Some episodes more than others.
So many things.
Right. Yes.
Everything at the grocery store.
Uh-huh. Most of the things at the grocery store. The whole like detoxifying thing really gets my blood boiling. And just this idea that like we have to eat a certain way or like take a certain pill or like do a certain supplement regimen to detoxify our bodies all of a sudden. Like our bodies are doing that all the time. You know, those kidneys, they're working hard. That liver is working hard. That hydrochloric acid is doing its job. Like our body is designed to detoxify itself and to get rid of toxins. So it kills me when companies are preying on this idea that we have to like kind of clean house and detoxify by buying their supplement, more or less.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah. Way, way too much of that out there and too easy for people to fall into that trap of spending lots of money on those kind of products. Amazing. Well, thank you all our listeners for listening to yet another episode of Arties versus BS podcast. And if you have any other topics you'd love to hear about that we haven't talked about yet, we'd love to hear from you. So keep sending us those suggestions on topics. But until next time, I'm Emily.
And I'm Marie.
And don't let the BS get the best of you.